Arvoisat läsnäolijat, tervetuloa seuraamaan väitöstilaisuutta, jossa filosofiamaisteri Paavo Nieminen puolustaa väitöskirjansa Multilayer Perception Training with Multi-Objective Memetic Optimization. Vastaväittäjänä toimii apulaisprofessori Carlos Cotta Malagan yliopistosta, Departamento Lenguajes y Ciencias de la Computación, informaatioteknologian tiedekunnan määräämänä kustoksena julistan väitöstilaisuuden alkaneeksi.
Mr. Kustos, Mr. Opponent, ladies and gentlemen, I shall now deliver my Lectio Precursoria. I will be talking in Finnish, but the slides are in English so that everyone in the lecture hall should be able to follow what I explain in layman's terms about the topic of my thesis, which is multilayer perceptron training with multi-objective memetic optimization. Arvoisa Kustos, kunnioitettu vastaväittäjä, hyvät kuulijat. Lectio Precursoria on väitöstilaisuuden alussa pidettävä suomenkielinen yleistajuinen esitys väitöskirjan aihepiiristä. Aikaa tähän on korkeintaan 20 minuuttia salinkellon mukaan, joiden aikana ehdin vain hieman avata väitöskirjani tieteen alaa sovelluksineen, ensinnäkemältä mahdollisesti hieman kryptiseltä vaikuttavia sanoja työn otsikossa, monikerroksisten hermoverkkojen muodostaminen memeettisen monitavoiteoptimoinnin avulla. Siis mitä ihmettä, sekä työni sisällön pääkohtia. Väitöskirjani tekstiin valitsemani 1980-lukulaisen määritelmän mukaan koneoppiminen tarkoittaa erilaisten luonnossa esiintyvien oppimisprosessien tutkimista ja mallintamista tietokoneella. Eli yritetään saada keinotekoinen kone oppimaan asioiden tekemistä kokemuksen ja toimintaympäristöstä tehtyjen havaintojen kautta. Kuten oppiminen luonnossakin, myös koneen oppiminen tarvitsee jonkinlaista oppimismenetelmään sisäänrakennettua ohjausta tai koulutusta. Koneoppiminen tutkimusalana oli vauhdissa jo ennen ensimmäisten yleiskäyttöisten tietokoneiden syntyä, myös ennen ohjelmointikielten syntyä. Tietokoneiden yhteydessä kyseinen kone tai laite itsessään ei tietenkään opi mitään, vaan se tietokoneohjelma oppii, jota kone suorittaa. Käytämme kuitenkin edelleen muinaisia termejä, koneoppiminen ja oppiva kone, koska nämä nyt jäivät elämään 1950-luvulla. Tämä tässä on Wikipediasta kopioitu kuva. Mitäpä tuolta piirtämään uudelleen, kun valmiiksi löytyy käyttökelpoinen ja vapaasti hyödynnettävä kuva. Tiedon ja tieteen, kuten myös taiteen, avoimuus ja uudelleen käytettävyys ovat nyt ja tulevaisuudessa tarpeellisia hyveitä, joihin kannustan jatkuvasti itseäni ja muita. Myös väitöskirjani lähdekoodit ovat julkisesti saatavilla. Takaisin asiaan. Kuvassa on karkea hahmotelma tyypillisestä hermosolusta, joita esimerkiksi ihmisen aivoissa on erään uuden 2015 arvion mukaan noin 86 miljardia kappaletta. Nykypäivästä katsoen varsin varhain, jo 1940-luvulla, tiedettiin hyvin, että eläimet, mukaan lukien tietysti ihmiset, käsittelevät informaatiota tällaisista soluista muodostuvien verkostojen kautta. Toimintamekanismista tiedettiin myös, että hermosolut yhdistyvät toisiinsa synapseilla, jotka välittävät signaaleja solujen välille. Tiedettiin, että kun keskenään eri vahvuisten synapsien välittämien signaalien yhteissumma ylittää tietyn kynnysarvon, hermosolu niin sanotusti laukeaa, eli tuottaa hetkellisen sähköisen sykäyksen kohti aina seuraavia hermosoluja näiden synapsien kautta. No, siitä se sitten lähti, mikä lähti se ajatus, että voitaisiin tehdä keinotekoisesti aivot, jotka toimisivat oikeiden biologisten aivojen tavoin. Tähän, kuten niin monen asian tieteessä, pureudutaan tietysti matemaattisten mallien kautta. Matematiikkahan on se tapa, jolla ilmiöt lopulta halutaan täsmällisesti kuvailla, löytää mallit eli kaavat, jotka selittävät luonnon ilmiöitä ja varsinkin niistä tehtyjä havaintoja. Itse käyttämäni malli on yksi varhaisimmista ja samalla yksinkertaisimmista malleista, joilla kuvaillaan keinotekoisia hermoverkkoja. Sen nimi on englanniksi Multilayer Perceptron. Suorin suomennos monikerrosperceptroni olisi ehkä vähän ruma, eikä välttämättä kovin puhutteleva sana. Työni otsikossa lukee siksi vain monikerroksinen hermoverkko. Vaikka tämä sanamuoto ei itsessään täysin kuvaile, millaisesta mallista on kyse. Kaavat sen sijaan kuvaavat mallin täysin. Kalvossani esiintyvät symbolit ja tietyt erikoisesti sovitut merkintätavat tietysti vaatisivat pidemmän selityksen kuin tässä ehtii. Kirjastani nämä löytyvät. Ilman näitä selityksiä matematiikkaa ymmärtäväkin henkilö joutuisi jokaisen kirjaimen ja symbolin kohdalla kysymään, miten mikäkin niistä on määritelty. Laitoin nämä kaavat tähän esityskalvoon lähinnä näyttääkseni, kuinka yksinkertaisesta koneistosta loppujen lopuksi on kyse, ainakin kaavojen pituuden mukaan laskettuna. Suurin piirtein tähän asti valmistelin tätä kuivakkaalla ja virallisella kirjakielellä tehtyä puhetta. Sitten tulin siihen tulokseen, että kyllähän tämä tuntuu omasta mielestäni aika kehnolta tavalta kommunikoida näin hienonnäköiselle yleisölle. Joten tehdään niin, että vedetään loput lonkalta nykyisellä omalla kielellä, eli Keski-Suomen murteella. Eiköhän siitä näin tule parempi. Puhun kuitenkin asiasta, josta jotakin tiedän, vaikka varmasti en niin paljon kuin nämä salissa edessä istuvat muut herrasmiehet ehkä tietävät. No, otsikossahan on tuo sana muodostaminen. Eli haluttaisiin muodostaa tavalla tai toisella tällainen keinotekoinen hermoverkko, joka sitten oppisi asioita tekemään. Tämä sana muodostaminen valittiin sen sijaan, että olisi käytetty sanaa kouluttaminen tai opettaminen. Niitähän me normaalisti käytetään, kun näistä puhutaan. Mutta vähän otsikon tasolla ajateltiin, että se saattaisi johtaa harhaan ajattelemaan, että kyseessä on joku ihmisten kouluttamiseen tai oppimiseen liittyvä asia, josta tässä ollaan kuitenkin aika kaukana. Mitä se oppiminen tässä tapauksessa tarkoittaa? Se on sitä, että tuollaiseen matemaattiseen kaavaan etsitään sopivat palaset, eli lukuarvot tiettyihin painokertoimiin ja tietyt funktiot sinne välille, ja sitten mietitään jollain tavalla, mikä se verkon rakenne pitäisi olla, eli kun siellä on näitä keinotekoisia hermosoluja ja niiden välisiä synapseja, niin miten niiden pitäisi liittyä toisiinsa. Tämä tehdään sillä tavalla, että tälle oppivalle ohjelmalle näytetään jonkinlaista esimerkkiaineistoa ja sitten meillä on jonkunlainen menetelmä sitten, joka nämä mallin parametrit sitten asettaa. Skynetti, sehän saavutti tietoisuuden vuonna 1997. Vai saavuttiko? Ilmeisesti ei. Tämähän on tästä Terminaattori-elokuvasta, vanhoista elokuvista. Uudemmiakin on. 2017 hän on tekeillä tämä Skynetti vasta. Tästä puhun sen takia, että kun tuolla kylillä on tottunut selittämään tästä aiheesta, niin mitä nyt töissä teen, niin tämä on semmoinen aika yleinen kysymys. Ja sellainen ajatus, joka ihmisiltä usein tulee siinä kohtaa, että Skynettiäkö teet, eli mitä tämä tarkoittaa, niin villiksi riistäytyvä tietokoneohjelma, joka oppii tiedostamaan ja sitten ymmärtää olevansa vaarassa ja tuhoaa ihmiset. No, voin vakuuttaa, että ei nykypäivän teknologialla tällaista pääse tapahtumaan. Jos verrataan nyt tähän ihmisen aivoon vaikka, jossa on 86 miljardia aivosolua. Tämä kyseinen tutkimushan itse asiassa oli aika mielenkiintoinen. Siinä todella laskettiin käytännössä yksitellen aivosolut kuoleman jälkeen aivonsa tieteelle lahjoittaneelta henkilöltä ja aivot tehtiin sellaiseksi mössöksi, josta pystyttiin sitten laskemaan tilavuuden sisältämien hermosolujen määrä plus miinus 10% tarkkuudella. Synapseja jonkun arvion mukaan on ehkä 1000 tai vähän reilu jokaista hermosolua kohti. Niin päästään sellaisiin lukemiin, että jos me nyt ihmisen aivojen kaikki synapsit saataisiin vaikka 10 tavulla mallinnettua, mikä on alakanttiin varmasti, niin sehän vaatisi tämmöisen noin petatavun verran tavaraa, mikä nyt tarkoittaa 10% Google Earthin kartoista, taikka sitten itse asiassa jopa vähemmän kuin tämä tunnetun nettipelin World of Warcraftin koko pelidata. Eli kyllähän tallennusmielessä ehkä pystyttäisiin aivot tietokoneelle tallentamaan helpostikin nykyään. Mutta kyllä se vaan niin on, että sitten todellisen hermosolun toiminnan mallintaminen niin matemaattisesti kuin varsinkin tietokoneella, jossa laskenta kestää aikaa, niin kyllä tässä ollaan alkutekijöissään, eli uusimmissa tutkimuksissa niin tuollaista hiekanjyvän kokoista rotan aivojen osaa on pystytty nykyisillä parhaimmilla malleilla mallintamaan. Eli kyllä ei tällä teknologialla vielä tuomiopäivän koneita tehdä. Sen voin luvata. Eri asia on se, että miten teknologia kehittyy, jos voidaan vaikka kasvattaa aivosoluja ja tehdä niistä biologisia aivoja. Mutta sitten se nostaa esiin eettisiä kysymyksiä, johon ei ehkä tässä luennossa tarvitse mennä. Ei hätää siis. Sen sijaan hyödyllisiä koneita. Semmoisia me voidaan kyllä tehdä. Eli nämä yksinkertaisimmatkin mallit, niin niitä käytetään päivittäin sovelluksissa. Meillä on muutama esimerkki tuossa kalvolla. Esimerkki voisi olla, että kun menee lääkäriin, niin siellä saatetaan mitata veriarvoja tai sitten ottaa joku vaikka valokuva ihosta, ihosyöpää tutkittaessa. No, sitten meillä on tämmöinen kone, joka on oppinut tunnistamaan kuin lääkäri, että onko siinä nyt sitten tätä tautia mahdollisesti tai ei. Eli tämmöisessä diagnostiikkasovelluksissa voidaan helposti ymmärtää, mihin voidaan käyttää tällaista oppivaa konetta. Sitten nostin tähän puheeseen tällaisen viime päivinä mediassa puhuttaneen aiheen, koska nythän on esimerkiksi niin, että Facebook ja muut nämä sosiaalisen median paikat netissä, ne sisältää koneoppimismenetelmiä, ja ne on aika eteviä arvaamaan opittuaan sun käyttäytymisestä, että minkälaisia uutisia haluat lukea, minkälaisia viestejä nähdä siellä feedissä, ja tästähän on ollut uutisissa sitten jonkin verran juttua tässä viime aikoina, että voiko siinä käydäkin niin, että syntyy tämmöisiä kuplia, joissa henkilö ei muita uutisia näekään kuin tietynlaisia, joita hän on aina halunnut nähdä, ja osa niistä saattaa olla jopa vääriä, tahallisestikin vääräksi tehtyjä uutisia. Menemättä näiden uutisten aiheisiin tarkemmin, niin haluan nostaa tässä kuitenkin sellaisen asian, että kuten äskenkin sanoin, niin kyllä tässä vielä on ihminen kuningas, eli näiden järjestelmien tekijät kyllä pystyvät päättämään, että mitä ne koneet oppivat, miten ne sen tekevät ja mihin niitä käytetään. Eli ongelmat ovat eettisiä. Itse onneksi saan tehdä perustutkimusta, jossa saa vaan tehdä hienoja työkaluja miettimättä eettisiä kysymyksiä, jotka ovat tärkeitä. Tämäkään suhteen ei hätää, kunhan joku ratkaisee nämä eettiset kysymykset. Mitä mä oon itse tehnyt, niin kirjahan käsittelee tämmöistä erityistapausta kuin luokittelu. No, se on esimerkiksi se diagnoosi. Onko henkilö sairas vai ei? Näissä kuvissa, joita kirjassakin on, niin meillä on 2 kappaletta mitattuja muuttujia. Olkoon ne X1 tai X2 tai jotain veriarvoja. Todellisessa tilanteessa ei ole näin helppoa, että voidaan vain piirtää joku raja vaikkapa ruksien ja ympyröiden välille. Näitä muuttujia nimittäin, joita mitataan, niitä voi olla tuhansia tai kymmeniä tuhansia, satoja tuhansia, miljoonia. Ei voida piirtää kuvia, Mutta nämä menetelmät, nämä kaavat, niin näillä pystytään pureutumaan tietenkin tiettyjen rajoitusten puitteissa niin sellaisiin kysymyksiin, joita ihminen ei pysty edes hahmottamaan piirtämällä. Missä kohtaa tämä menee vielä vaikeammaksi myös tietokoneelle? On se, että jos meillä havaintoaineisto meneekin tuolla tavalla ikävästi päällekkäin, eli siellä onkin samanlaisia mittauksia sekä sairailla että terveillä tapauksilla, niin sitten mikä tahansa malli siihen laitettu, niin se tekee jonkun verran vääriä ratkaisuja molempiin suuntiin. Tulee vääriä positiivisia, vääriä negatiivisia tuloksia. Tämä on sama tilanne, minkä edessä lääkäri on. Ja näitä sitten tietyin tavoin mitataan, joka kiinnostaa meitä myös näissä koneoppimisasioissa samalla tavalla. Toinen ongelma on se, että sitten jos ei tiedetä, miten yksinkertainen malli pitäisi olla. Tuossa oikeanpuoleisessa kuvassa on sitten monimutkaisempi malli, joka tekee vähemmän virheitä molempiin suuntiin, mutta se hukkaa sitten aivan täysin tuon ilmiön, mikä tuolla takana on. Tämäkään ei ole toivottu tilanne. Miten näitä voi ratkoa, niin monitavoiteoptimointi. Eli silloin, kun meillä on mahdollisuutta tehdä virhettä erilaisiin suuntiin, siitä tulee niin monta tavoitetta kuin on niitä luokiteltavia asioita. Ja sitten, jos halutaan sen lisäksi vielä mallintaa tai mallin yksinkertaisuutta mitata, niin se on sitten aina plus yksi tavoite. Tämä on se monitavoiteoptimointi, minkä ääressä olen työskennellyt tässä. Tarkemmin sanottuna, mitä se monitavoitteisuus käytännön elämässä voisi tarkoittaa. Se tulee seuraavalla kalvolla. No voin kertoa. Se on esimerkiksi sitä, että olet ostamassa autoa. Haluat yhtä aikaa halvan ja miellyttävän, mukavan auton, niin ei onnistu. Pitää tehdä valintoja, kompromisseja. Ja jos löytyy sitten malli, joka on sekä halvempi että sitten mukavampi, niin silloin se edellinen vaihtoehto varmasti ei ollut edes monitavoitteisesti ajatellen optimaalinen. Sitä se käytännössä tarkoittaa. Ja tällä kaupallahan mulla oli tosiaan esimerkkejä siitä, mihin näissä monikerroksissa hermoverkoissa voidaan soveltaa näitä tavoitteita tai mitä tavoitteita sieltä löytyy. Eli itse asiassa näistä jo useampaa tuossa käsittelinkin. Kirjassa on sitten todella lisää ja luulen, että tänään keskustellaan näistä vielä. Sitten kun meillä on erilaisia kompromisseja olemassa, niin näitähän on ryhmä vaihtoehtoja. Ja voitaisiinko käyttää sanaa populaatio? Ja tarkoittaisiko se populaatio vaikka samaa kuin joku ihmispopulaatio tai eläinpopulaatio luonnossa, niin itse asiassa hyvinkin. Nythän toinen tapa, millä luonto oppii, niin se on evoluutio. Ja myös sitä tietotekniikan alusta asti, ohjelmoinnin alusta asti on pyritty mallintamaan matemaattisesti ja tietokoneella. Eli mallinnettu sitä, miten evoluutio darwinilaisittain toimii. Sitten mallinnetaan DNAta hyvin yksinkertaistetuilla malleilla. Mallinnetaan populaatio, jossa on tietyt geenit, jotka siirtyy sitten lisääntymisen kautta seuraavalle sukupolvelle. Ja sitten on luonnonvalintaa, parhaat selviytyy parittelemaan keskenään. Tästä on syntynyt toinen laskennallisen tieteen osa-alue, populaatiopohjaiset, erityisesti evoluutioalgoritmit. Toki näitä on käytetty yhdessä hermoverkkojen tutkimuksen kanssa, eli onkin tehty näistä keinotekoisista hermoverkoista tällainen populaatio, jota kilpailutetaan keskenään, pariutetaan keskenään, saadaan parempi uusi populaatio. Näillä on pitkät taustat näillä menetelmillä ja niiden yhdistelmillä. Yksi algoritmikin tuolla kalvossa vilahtaa, en lähde avaamaan sitä. pääkohta ehkä se, että myös nämä optimointimenetelmät, millä haetaan parhaita ratkaisuja, nämäkin loppujen lopuksi ovat aika lyhyitä, kun ne sitten kompaktissa muodossa kirjoitetaan auki. Ei auki, vaan kirjoitetaan ne kompaktiin muotoon. Se auki kirjoittaminen, siitähän tulee se ohjelmakoodi, jota voi olla tuhansia rivejä. Se on sitten eri asia. Asioiden ymmärtäminen algoritmien kautta, esimerkiksi tällainen evoluutiomallintaminen, tuossa se kiteytettynä on. Mutta siinä otsikossa on vielä eri sana. Siinä on memeettinen algoritmi. Memeettiset algoritmit on sitten sitä, kun lisätään tuohon evoluutiomallin lisäksi malli siitä, kuinka elinaikana populaatio oppii, ja sitten se tieto tallentuisi sinne seuraavaan populaatioon ikään kuin geenissä. Näinhän ei oikeasti tapahdu, mutta silti kun se vanhempi malli, Jean-Baptiste Lamarckin ennen Darwinia kehittämä evoluutiomalli, otetaan näihin tietokoneohjelmiin, niin siitäpä onkin siellä hyötyä, saadaan entistä tehokkaampia, parempia optimointimenetelmiä. Kirjassani otan tällaisen käsikirjan lähtökohdaksi, jossa kirjan toimittajina olivat tämmöiset Neri, Kotto ja Moscato. Nerin Ferrante on sen verran tuttu jäbä, että ei missään olosuhteessa voinut kuvitella häntä omaksi vastaväittäjäksi, minkä takia Carlos Kotto istuu salissa näin. Ja Pablo Moscato ilmeisesti on tekijämiehen siinä mielessä, että viikko sitten sain onnittelut ja ilmoituksen, että memeettisten algoritmien Facebook-sivulla on tämä minun vielä toistaiseksi tarkastamaton työ julkaistu siinä vaiheessa kaikille asiasta kiinnostuneille tutkijoille. Joten, on ollut hyvin aikaa varata lennot ja tulla saliin esittämään pahoja lisäkysymyksiä. Toivottavasti niitä ei liiemmin tule. Itse kirjassa käyn läpi tarkemmin nämä kaavat, menettelyt. Käyn läpi tarkoin historian ja sitten kuvailen nykypäivän algoritmeja, ohjelmia, mitä niissä pitäisi olla, että tämä otsikon mukainen asia voidaan hoitaa hyvin. Lähdekoodiakin tein ja se on julki. Yksi luku kirjassa on erillinen muista. Se on itse asiassa työkaluohjelmisto kirjallisuuskatsauksen tekemiseen. Kirjani neljäs luku on käytännön esimerkki siitä, kuinka sitä sitten käytellään. Olen ollut mukana ryhmässä, joka on kehittänyt tällaista työkalua. Tällaisista asioista me tänään keskustelemme. Yhteenvetona ei huolta, enemmän ole tuomiopäivän koneita. Yksinkertaisia matemaattisia malleja. Tällä kalvolla on yksi tärkeä pointti tälle yleisölle. Näkisin, että tässä on ladattu ase, jolla tehdään paljon hyvää tutkimusta, kun siihen saadaan aikaa, eli opiskelijoita, eli kandi, maisteri, tutkielmien aiheita, ohjelmointiprojektien aiheita, niin saapi kun pyytää. Sitten aivan eri asioista kaverini väittelee, joissa olen ollut hieman jeesaamassa mukana tulevaisuuden mobiiliverkoista. Tänään puhumme memeettisistä algoritmeista monikerroksisen hermoverkon luomisessa. May I ask you, Mr. Associate Professor, as the opponent appointed by the faculty, to present the comments to my thesis that you see justifiable?
Certainly. This thesis lies at the intersection of three major research areas, which are neural computation, memetic computing, and multi-adaptive optimization. Each of these three research areas is valuable on its own. And for example, machine learning in all of its form, neural computing is a part of machine learning, is one area that tries to capture the long-standing goal of achieving computational counterparts to the processes in the brain, the cognitive processes that give rise to human intelligence, or at least to provide a computational emulation of the high-level functionality of the brain. Then we have mimetic algorithms, which are a part of the broader area of evolutionary computing. And these represent also an attempt to use ideas from biological evolution and for cultural evolution as well to solve complex optimization problems. It turns out that natural computation in all its forms, be it neural computing or evolutionary computing, have a common point underlying, which is this use of natural metaphors for problem solving. And actually, neural computing and evolutionary algorithms are two of the cornerstones of so-called soft computing, which is the modern flexible form of artificial intelligence. So whereas classical artificial intelligence was aimed to do some kind of symbolic reasoning or try to do some logic inference in order to explicitly emulate those cognitive processes in the brain, so emulate artificial intelligence by means of the explicit use of a logical argument. In soft computing, what we have is that we try to provide the means for that intelligence to arise as an emergent property of the system. So we provide the means, be it as a neural network, be it as an emulation of natural evolution, in order for this complex behavior to arise. Then we have a third component, which is multi-objective optimization, which naturally fits very well with evolutionary algorithms, as the candidate has explained. In short, this captures the very essence of most real-world problems, which are multifaceted. So we have conflicted objectives in which you cannot simply optimize one of them without degrading the performance in the remaining objective. So this underpins that the topics dealt with in the thesis are of the highest value and importance for the current research being conducted. And then we have a fourth element, which has not taken a lot of time in this lectio precursoria, but that I also find quite interesting, which is the last part, this data mining task in which the candidate has explored the literature available in these topics, and using for this purpose some complex mathematical and algorithmic tools in order to identify which are the most important references, digest them, and try to filter out those that are relevant, combining them in a coherent way. I find this particularly important in a time in which we are now, in which there is some kind of explosion in the number of journals and conferences, and it is not always easy to keep up with the pace at which new publications appear. So this kind of automated data mining tools find are of the most interest. So generally speaking, this simply emphasizes that the topic and the work contained in this thesis is highly important. This is my general statement about the contents of the thesis. Now, of course, I have a number of questions that have arisen during my reading of the manuscript that I would like to share with the candidates. So, please. So let's start with some very general issues. Well, the work has centered around the use of neural networks, in particular multi-layer perceptrons for classification, and then the use of multi-objective mimetic algorithms for training or designing these networks. If we focus, for example, on natural computing, one of the phenomena that have been observed very recently is that there has been an enormous explosion of so-called new natural algorithms. So we have the classical genetic algorithms or classical swarm algorithms based on evolution or based on the behavior of insects. But now we have algorithms based on almost every possible biological or natural process, like bees, elephants, giraffes, whatever you can imagine, someone has invented that. And it turns out that all of those purportedly new algorithms are actually just the good old algorithms with some new terminology. So I was wondering to what extent this can also be said about the neural networks used in this work. Because, for example, we know that radial basis functions are equivalent to fuzzy logic. And then we have other tools which are commonly used by statistical community, like principal components analysis, or we have polynomial regression. So in which sense does the candidate believe that neural networks are relevant in this context rather than use any other classical statistical method?
Yes, thank you. That's a very good question. In here, we have to go back some time, and the process of starting my work with this machine learning stuff. We had algorithms already implemented by my supervisor, and I started actually working with neural networks just because they were there. My job was to try to improve them and not other methods. But then, honestly, I have to say that while first learning about all these different kinds of methods, which you mentioned, all these statistical methods and their machine learning variants, which are more or less similar but not the same thing. Looking at all of these different methods, there was honestly a period when I experienced some lack of motivation in doing my current job with multilayer perceptrons, because it seemed to be that everybody is now writing about support vector machines only. And so what am I doing with this 80s stuff with multilayer perceptrons? But then, later this problem went away when I actually realized that there are other issues that affect these things more, like pre-processing of the data, making sure that your data is of good quality, large enough, so on. Then comparing these methods, it would seem that MLPs are still okay, and they are simple to implement, to understand. Well, maybe not understand fully, because then you have to actually spend some years on the topic, which I've been doing. And then this is the tool that I know best myself. So I was, in the end, I was very confident in using this in my thesis and the work presented. I hope I answered your question. These other methods are really interesting and very good, and they have their strong points, definitely.
Okay, yes, I think so. My next question is about what I believe is one of the milestones in the recent history of heuristic optimization and learning, which is the no-free lunch theorem. This theorem is states that for an arbitrary problem, all algorithms are going to behave on average the same. And it can also be applied to learning algorithms. So it can be proved that there is no a priori distinction between different learning algorithms. So unless you take into account the features of the problem you want to solve or the data that you want to classify in some sense, then you cannot expect one particular classifier or one particular algorithm to perform better than any other one. Now, by inspecting the thesis I did a search, and the theorem is not seated, but I find it's very important also because the fact that we have a memetic algorithm is actually because of this theorem, or this theorem motivates theoretically the need for memetic algorithms, because memetic algorithms were a bit earlier than the no-free lunch theorem. So my question is, how is this work coping with the limitations of search and learning algorithms in particular? Well, we know since the times of Marvin Minsky's work that the perceptron was inherently limited, and that's why you needed a multi-layer and so on. So how do you cope with the limitations of the training algorithm? Do you consider in some way how to extract or identify features of the data set, or that would indicate that you have to design your learning algorithm in some way?
Okay. Where to start from here? Yes, you mentioned no free lunch theorems and this. Well, I've been looking at this no free lunch theorems and full employment theorems. I've also been warned that you have to be very careful about their requisite. What is it called actually in English? This logically the foundations of the theorems when they are valid and when not. I decided not to discuss them in the thesis, but yes, I'm familiar with this. And then why, if your question was how do I cope with those limitations of, let's say, multilayer perceptron or these evolutionary algorithms with certain operators. I think, as I hope I have written in the text, I think there is memetic algorithms can incorporate different operators where you can select the one that most fits the problem. I think they are memetic approach is the perfect framework for trying as much as you can to circumvent these no free lunch issues. Then it is a larger problem how to find out what operators this problem needs. That I haven't considered. I know it should always be considered. So far, of course, practical applications have been so that it's still trial and error. But and it's a magnum opus to create these sort of adaptive ways to find proper pieces for the algorithm, even if it could incorporate those that are suitable for a task. It is definitely an interesting large problem to consider. But humbly, in one thesis, I focused on some things and left out
okay.
some of the future things, let's say, or okay. things for other persons also.
Good. Well, yeah. So I have a third general question, which in this case is about multi-objective optimization. I have the feeling that in many occasions, multi-objective optimization has become more an academic issue than a real-world issue. So in multi-objective optimization, you are interested in finding as many non-dominated solutions as possible, so you want to spread all over the Pareto front. However, when it comes to a real-world application, it's often the case that you are not using that Pareto front at all, and you have a very usually a very clear idea of where are the solutions of interest. So actually you are citing two applications in the thesis. One application is by Paul Wigan and collaborators. They were working on a real-time face recognition problem, and another one was by Capel and collaborators. And in this case, they were working on minimizing the number of sensors in a portable pH determination unit. And in both cases, it turned out that the solution selected was one of the streams of the Pareto front, the solution with the lowest complexity. So my question is, to which extent is really multi-objective optimization needed in this context? So wouldn't just, given the examples that has been cited, that we could consider this as a sequence of single objective optimization problems, each of them with an increasing complexity?
Can you clarify, please, the last detail of your question?
If you are using two objectives, one is, for example, the accuracy of your predictor or some other quality measure, and another one is the complexity, and at the end you are just picking the solution with the lowest complexity, which satisfies your minimum threshold of quality. So wouldn't you just achieve the same result if instead of doing a full multi-objective approach, you had just said, okay, I'm going to limit my complexity to this, I'm going to see what I obtain, and then if it is not good enough, I increase the complexity and see what I get, and so on?
Yes. Okay, I see. Yes, this was the clarification I needed. So start with low complexity, then step up and, mm-hmm. and do accuracy search. Okay, that's how we used to do it. I came from multi-objective background, I actually. I'm citing the paper. It's I believe from Yin and Senthoff, some early work about Pareto optimization, Pareto based, which they mean that instead of actually picking the final solution, you would examine the Pareto front, and that I think is the holy grail of this thing. Not to decide a priori or by iteration, but use an algorithm that finds your possibilities so that from the Pareto front, by examining it, you would actually learn properties of your data set and stuff. Unfortunately, I'm not there yet. I have the roadmap, and I strongly believe that is the target we should be aiming at, Pareto-based methods, where it is important not to pick one by one, but instead get the spread out Pareto front, and then examine, perhaps with numeric measures of the distribution of the Pareto front, or just by human examination of figures, which you can do in 3D and even 4D, actually using color or other aspects for the fourth dimension. To use the human computational power of the brain to see from the Pareto front image, maybe my data actually works this and this way. I think this is the goal, and this has been the target of the research, which is documented in the thesis.
You have mentioned a couple issues about analysis of this Pareto front that actually in my checklist to ask you later, but a more specific issue, so I will return to that later. Now I wanted to ask you a couple of more specific questions. I shall start with the following. So in the thesis, you introduce machine learning, and then you go on to discuss multi-layer perceptrons, but also mention other models of neural networks. You mentioned radio-based functions, you mentioned support better machines, and at some point in the thesis, we can even find mentions to other models, like for example, decision trees, not necessarily neural networks, but machine learning methods. And I missed here in the thesis a mention to what I believe is a major paradigm within machine learning, which actually I think that shares a lot of issues, of some of the basic issues with neural networks in general and multi-layer perceptrons in particular. I'm talking about Bayesian networks. So why there is no mention to Bayesian networks? Because you have the very same issue of having to fit a certain set of data without overfitting, and then you have the issue of the complexity of the model, because of course you're learning a probability distribution over a set of data, and this probability distribution gets better in terms of accuracy if you add a lot of dependencies. So you want also to minimize the dependencies, which is exactly the main point that has been tackled in the thesis with from the point of view of multi-layer perception. So why hasn't been any mention to Bayesian networks? Or
yes, why Bayesian networks are not mentioned? Well, here the honest answer is that while I try to be quite systematic in that I really understand what I'm writing about, and I'm not writing about some things that I don't yet understand. It is definitely an important group of methods. So far, I haven't gone deep enough into that to actually write much about it. So I must say it is an omission in the thesis work. Yes, I admit.
Okay. I just read
deliberate one talk.
Yeah, it was particularly exciting for me because besides the fact that having working with Bayesian networks, I have more experience with Bayesian networks than with multi-layer perceptrons, is the fact that at some point, you define this method, this weight decay method, that tries to minimize the complexity of the neural network. And just by inspection of the mathematical formula that you obtained there, I could just see the same mathematical terms that you find in the so-called Bayesian information criterion, which is to minimize the probability of the conditional probability of the data given the probabilistic model minus one half of the number of free parameters and so on. So it's exactly the same shape of the mathematical formula. So that's why it is very clear. And this also links with another factor which has a more wider applicability, which is the idea of minimum description length. So you are describing a set of data. So you need to take into account, of course, the complexity of the descriptor and the complexity of the error that you're obtaining. So this is essentially what is being taken here into account. So I really think that you should look into that, if only to find some similarities and connections within the general issue, because what is being done in one field and works in one field maybe also works in the other field. So this is just a remark, okay? Now I have related to this complexity issue. So essentially, this is actually the point of this weight decay method, that in some sense you are trying to minimize the weights of the connections and attribute a lower complexity to a neural network with these lowest weights. But to which extent is this realistic or really representative? Because what is the difference if you have a neural network with bounded weights, so you have your weights bounded between minus one and one or any other bound, and what's the difference between having a weight 1 or having a weight 10 to the minus 5. So unless you can say that any weight below this threshold is equivalent to 0, so I forget about this, and the performance of the neural network is essentially the same if you forget about that link. In that case, it would make sense to take that as a function or some indication of the complexity. But if not, I find it a bit in the air that you are using these weights as an indication of complexity. So I don't know what's your vision of this, or what do you think of?
Yes. Yep. This weight values, whether they are large or small, they're one way of measuring. I hope I used this word that it's a proxy for how complex the network is. This is what I've been working most with neural networks. Our initial things were about weight decay, it's been a matter of interest. I'm not sure what your actual question was. Was it what do I think about this as a measure of complexity?
Exactly. Yeah.
Then I can easily answer. I think it's one way of measuring with its implications. Because you can count number of active neurons. That gives you some kind of idea about let's say the structural complexity. Then, because in neural networks you can have many small weights that actually mean the same thing as one large weight, basically. So it lacks information when you just compute the average value or the sum of the squared weights or something. Then you don't know how it is distributed in actual neurons that are contributing to the sum, because it's a sum. Then the point in what I think is that with this multi-objective optimization, we can visualize the Pareto front. If there would be different individuals with how large the weights are and how many of them are active non-zero in the network, so you could compare, let's say, this structural complexity, number of connections. Contrast that with, let's say, mean value or maximum value or sum of the weights, and then see how they relate. If they tell the same story, then your Pareto front is just one point. If they seem to be telling the different story, then you'd want to look into it. Why is this? How are these actual individuals different? Let's say this is the goal.
Okay.
I answered.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, I really would be very nice to have some experimental analysis indicating what happened with those low weight links, whether they are really expendable and you can forget about them, or they really, because then you have some nonlinear dependency. So it may be that that small weight at the end makes a difference. So
yes, I definitely would like to do those experiments and see the Pareto front and see how these different measures of complexity are related to the accuracy, which is of course that's if it's as simple as getting one accuracy for, let's say, binary classification, then I would like to see how this relates to the different complexity measures.
Okay. Good. One more question about multilayer perceptrons. In my opinion, they have one one problem. This is one problem with multi-layer perceptions. They are something like a Scottish bagpipe. So you have the input, you have the output, but nobody knows what's happening inside. So this means you cannot obtain a very good performance, but it is often difficult to understand, to interpret the results. You can, of course, come up with this geometrical interpretation, but some other methods allow for a more, let's say, close to the human way of analyzing the data. So how do you think this interpretability issue could be handled? Because Bayesian network mentioned before, they have a very explicit representation of the knowledge, so it's very easy to understand them. Also, radial basis functions, which are analogous to fuzzy logic, they have a more or less direct interpretation. Multilayer perceptors know so much. So, how do you think this could be handled, this interpretability issue?
I think with multilayer perceptrons, I think with large networks, you're probably going to be a little bit lost with the interpretability kind of no-can-do situation, because it gets very, very complex compared to radial basis functions, where you know locations of your distributions there in the data. So I think with smaller networks, it's more manageable, maybe. But still, it's definitely, it's multilayer perceptron is a black box.
Yeah,
black box for good.
Okay, so I'm now returning to the Pareto front, to the analysis of the Pareto front. One of the issues that is not being dealt so much in the thesis, besides a couple of examples that I mentioned before, is this final decision making about which solution to select for from the Pareto front. There's one reference about when you discuss applications in finance, you mentioned Sharp index, which is quite interesting, because this is actually a way of measuring or selecting a solution from the Pareto front based on a trade-off between risk and return. So in Sharp index, what you do is that you define which is the so-called riskless return, and that's a point on the y-axis, and then you draw a line which is tangent to the Pareto front, and the point that is just at that intersection to this tangent is the point that you select from the Pareto front, which is, in terms of financial applications, it makes sense. So I don't know if this could be done here. There is actually one quote on page 78. I think I have it here.
I hope we have the same numbers.
Hopefully.
78, you say.
Yeah. So you say, could more of the various criteria you're referring to the criteria used for assessing, selecting or validating your predictor, could more of the various criteria be introduced as explicit optimization objectives in a holistic algorithm that performs more of the necessary stages in a single run? So this is section 336. Is the last paragraph?
Last paragraph of 336. Okay.
So the paragraph starts, as seen from the digest here, with more evidence, blah, 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 and then you state, could more of the various criteria be introduced as explicit optimization objectives? I don't know if you are here giving a clue that maybe the the final decision process could be also a part of the optimization process. Are you referring to this here?
Yes, okay. Moment, I will check what I'm talking about in this chapter. Okay, so it was... yep. Uh-huh. Oh, okay, I found a typo as well. Whoa. Okay, so it was about this prediction intervals. And yeah, okay. Okay. Yeah, yes, yes, definitely, yes. We can have a better discussion about this when we would be looking at the cited paper. So this, yes, okay. I remember the time when my imagination was fed by this, that in the paper, we should see what is in the paper. And what the stages were, which are referred to here. Yeah, I'm sure I must have been thinking. They use different, if I'm not remembering wrong, which I might do, is that they had stages where they optimize something, then another stage where they optimize another thing, either using a constraint for the earlier and then changing the thing or just optimizing towards a new criteria, criterion. But yes, I think my imagination was fed by thinking, what if we actually use this at once? Just put not stage by stage, but just run it once with the different objectives.
Okay. So
my memory doesn't fail me. It was the moment was like this when I wrote this.
Okay. So it's not exactly what they had interpreted at the beginning, which is fine because you can consider the possibility that if you had some knowledge of the decision making process that you're going to conduct afterwards, then you can include that into the optimization process.
Yes.
If you know that you some particular region of the Pareto front is going to be more interesting for you, then there's no point really in trying to obtain a whole bunch of solutions outside from that region, because
yes. That is true, and in this case, why should you be using a multi-objective method, at least as the outer loop? If you have a knowledge about the goal, then
exactly, just that's it.
Use single objectives.
Exactly, that's
it. Yeah,
that's the point. Okay, so now what usually happens, and this leads to my next question, is that. This decision-making criterion is not known in advance, or even if it is known, sometimes it's not usable by your optimization algorithm because it lacks a proper formalization, or it is maybe defined by some subjective judgment by the human user, or some other issue that may be not exactly well-defined in order to use inside a fitness function. So this actually leads to including the user in the loop, and you say in on page 84 you actually say perhaps it's by close to the end of the page, it's the second the last but one item in this list.
Perhaps the human decision-making capabilities could be exploited more by engaging the decision-maker more in the final model selection process. So I think that you are referring to this, having the some kind of maybe interactive or some kind, some user input during the process. Is it, or?
Yes, I may have been unclear if your thoughts would have gone that way. I think this is about the holistic examination of the Pareto front, mm-hmm. which I was talking about some minutes ago. I believe I meant this and not other things. So basically, this point here, this bullet point is about these methods where you use multi-objective optimization and then you select a single solution automatically instead of letting the human to inspect this. And in some cases, it seems to work. They have mm-hmm. published results where this is fine. It is a question that raises in my mind. If you just, instead of picking, would show the front, I'm sure that depending on the problem, it would improve the decision-making process. The key point is learning more about your problem. Maybe it has some interesting solutions in other places, not only the one that would have been selected. And then you learn your problem maybe was not the problem you thought it was. This is the...
Actually, I think that's more than... In a sense, you're right. But I think that a better characterization is the following. Better than learn about the problem, it's learning about the human interpretation of the problem, which is a bit different because... there's a lot of literature on using interactive evolutionary algorithms, and you can use the user input in many different places for selecting solutions, for evaluating solutions, for many things. So one of the key points here, in order to reduce the workload on the human user, you don't want him or her to be constantly looking at the display or hitting keys or whatever. So one of the key is being proactive. So the algorithm has to anticipate what the user wants, given that the user has previously given some input, and then, your algorithm has to learn what the user wants. So you need machine learning for that. So somehow this gently closes the loop because you are using machine learning to learn the preferences of the user on machine learning task. So. I find this quite an elegant or self-contained solutions that I think it's really worth exploring. So hopefully it will be explored. I don't know if you had any plans of doing this kind of research or.
I hope this roadmap can continue. I was talking in Finnish in the start, but I already mentioned to the students that. Master thesis topics are available upon request.
Okay,
need workforce with time to do the actual stuff.
Fine.
Yeah.
Good. Let's talk about evolutionary algorithm. Let's talk about evolutionary algorithms. One of the issues that is mentioned in many parts of the thesis is the fact that. Many applications or many uses of evolutionary algorithms for optimizing this kind of functions do not use any crossover operator, and you go to some lengths to explain why it's the difficulties associated with this. Then again, you also. Recognize the relevance of crossover. I think that it's on page 69 that you say that just by the end of section 332, you say, since the recombination operator is known to be a crucial element in evolutionary algorithm, it is a remarkable asset to have one available for singular free photograph networks. Okay, so what are your ideas of using crossover recombination? Should we really forget about recombination in this context, or is this some way in which we can really use recombination in a meaningful way?
Recombination in a meaningful way.
In a meaningful way, I mean, in a way in which your search process is really improved by using recombination.
Mm. Yep. Yeah. Definitely, this would remain to be seen. I cannot promise that it can be done, but there's a plan at my home on the table with a possible
crossover.
Possible crossover for MLP networks, and it's, if you look at my codes, it's on the to-do list. There's a couple of more things before that. Then to try it, see if it works.
So could you give just a high-level description of what is the idea of that recombination operator, or it's how would it work, or which are the information units that it would be combining, or
would be based on grouping the neurons based on this kind of cosine distance or something that if you look at any of my figures, you'd always have the direction of the first layers separating planes, which then are summed into nonlinear boundaries. So the idea is to take two MLPs, take the same layer from the two, then see the cosine distance or similar measure between each of these neurons, then combine those that are somewhat close to each other, maybe use clustering to decide a new number of neurons. Then you make that many clusters, could be random choice between sizes of the originals, like the parents. Then you decide if one has 10, one has 20, then your child has random value of neurons between 10 and 20, or some extension. Then you make clustering of the all the neurons in the parents, then you make some kind of, let's say, mean direction and use those as the new directions. Then in my imagination, without seeing the code and the results, in my imagination this would be a meaningful crossover between MLP networks. Now it has some problems, because there's not only in MLP, there's not only the direction, there's only also the distance from origin or the bias value in there, and then there are these symmetries. So it's not as straightforward as
Of course
as
it is. Told.
It's not as straightforward, but if these were tackled, I believe it could be a meaningful crossover. And there's I'm citing one paper where they are using very similar stuff. And I think that should be the first step, implement that, then see how to fix their problems, because I think that method would run into problems with the bias value, for example, or possibly the symmetries.
Yeah, my vision on that is that that you have this symmetry or this permutation problem in that you want to recombine things, you want to make sure that you're recombining the meaningful things, so you're not so there's a very related problem for example in clustering. So if you look at some of the approaches in the literature for doing clustering with evolutionary algorithms, you have the same problem, because you have two different clusterings of a set of objects, and how do you recombine them? So yes, you have to do some matching between those the clusters from one parent and the other one, and then try to see how you combine them. I think that the key is right to look at some phenotypic feature of the network. Also because not necessarily, and this is something that you have to take into account, not necessarily, although you mentioned that at some point, that the neuron is the minimal unit, in all that it is in this invisible, something like that. I don't remember now where you mentioned that. But not necessarily you have to take the neuron as the unit of recombination. So, because actually, if you have a multi-layer perceptron, it will be the case that you will have several neurons that are working together. So you want to identify those modules, so to say, and you want to see, for example, by going through the data to see, to try to identify those modules, which are those neurons that are currently classifying some parts of the data, and then try to use this information to define a sensible way of splicing the network in pieces so that you respect those modules, so you do not simply mix everything.
Yeah.
Then there's another issue, which is that even if your recombination operator is not meaningful at all, maybe it's not harmful either. So maybe you don't lose anything for using even a purely designed recombination operator, because it's just some kind of mutation that you have. Yeah. So there are many things that that can be done here. So just a couple of suggestions that you can follow. And also, yes, I had here reading that. There are some tools. I don't think if this has been done in this context, but in many combinatorial optimization problems, this is not a combinatorial optimization problem, but you can also use some of those tools. You use ideas from landscape analysis, so you try to see which is the landscape you are navigating, and then learning about the features of that landscape can help you in designing the different elements of your algorithm. So I'm not sure if anything has been done in the area of neural networks about landscape analysis and designing appropriate operators based on the features of the landscape. So I think that's another whole field where something can be, inspiration at least, can be sought. Okay. So now about the mimetic algorithm. One of the most distinctive features of mimetic algorithm is, of course, the fact that you're using a local search component inside the main evolutionary cycle of the algorithm. In a standard single objective optimization, it makes a lot of sense. In multi-objective optimization, now the thing is a bit different, because you do local search, you try to follow some gradients, but gradient according to which objective, because you have many. So how is this issue tackled here? Because you can do backpropagation and minimize the error or maximize the accuracy of your predictor, but you can be biasing the search towards a particular region of the Pareto front.
Yep. Yes, this is a problem, and you can see from trying to do what I'm doing at the moment in the codes, for example, pick a random direction at every step, it will oscillate. Not good. I think the solution to this was given, for example, by you yesterday in the guest lecture. Somehow encode the search direction in the individual, then. Change that or diverge to two directions, bringing about two new individuals.
Mm-hmm. That would be a clever solution.
Not abrupt changes or random at each iteration, but something that evolves with the individual. Mm-hmm. So that the local search
There are also some works, some of the initial works on multi-objective memetic algorithms tackle this issue. One way is, as you mentioned, by defining some random direction in every step. So not in every step of the local search, but every time that you do local search, to do that in a different random direction. So that means that eventually you are covering or direction. So you are expanding your current front toward all directions of the true Pareto front. Another option is to use a local search mechanism which is based on Pareto dominance. So you check your neighborhood and you pick a non-dominated or a solution that dominates your current solution. And do always these non-dominated moves, and somehow you navigate again through the search space towards the Pareto vector front. So these are some other possibilities that could be done here.
Definitely.
Okay. Another thing, and now talking again about multi-objective optimization. One of the things that I have been very little mentioned in the manuscript is to the use of multi-objective indicators. In order to evaluate the performance of multi-objective optimization, you typically use some performance indicator because one of the realizations about multi-objective optimization is that the evaluation of the performance is itself a multi-objective problem, because you can evaluate the performance in many different ways. So there are many indicators. And the fact is that there is some indirect reference to those indicators. For example, if we go to page 56, which is section 3-7, you're talking about the receiver operation characteristic curves, those rock curves. Just by the end of the second paragraph, you say that evolutionary Pareto-based learning could be used to optimize all of these errors simultaneously, and the resulting Pareto front could be interpreted as a multidimensional rock surface from which the decision maker could select a preferred compromise model. Okay, so interpreting this Pareto front as a multidimensional rock surface actually means that what you are measuring here, this area under the curve, is the hypervolume. This is a hypervolume indicator of multi-objective algorithms. And then later on, in two paragraphs before, after that, you say, then the performance of a Pareto front, rock surface A, compared to that of front B, would be defined by a non-symmetric measure, delta AV, by computing the volume of the simplex dominated by solutions in A, but not by those in V. And that's exactly another commonly used indicator in multi-objective optimization, which is the IHD indicator, A sub HD, which is the hypervolume difference, essentially. So it turns out that the issues of using indicator functions is are present in the thesis, although not explicitly. In that direction, one of the trends in designing multi-objective evolutionary algorithms has been to introduce those indicators in the algorithm. So we have those classical NSGA2 or SPIA2 or whatever, but we also have so-called indicator-based evolutionary algorithms in which you are directly trying to maximize the hypervolume covered by your population. And in doing so, you're looking for the true Pareto front, or you are trying to maximize typically any other unary indicator. So if the coverage of the literature here is broad enough, and I think it may be, then this means that this kind of use is not considered in the literature, apart from these two examples that are mentioned here, but maybe the authors of those references were not aware of that connection. I don't know. Then it could be also a way of integrating the local search in your algorithm, because you could just follow the direction that maximizes some indicator. So the direction that maximizes hypervolume, or the direction that maximizes or minimizes any other indicator that you may be using. So again, these are suggestions for you for future work. Because I understand that they have not been considered in this context.
Yes, you're correct. In my work, I didn't go that far yet. Yeah.
Good. Okay. We are now getting into chapter 4. So chapter 4 is quite interesting. I said that at the beginning. Because this kind of tools for automatically searching and mining the literature are of the foremost interest. For me as a researcher, I would like to have that. It's also remarkable that you have used that, and the chapter 3 actually emanates from the use of that tool. So that's a proof of concept that the tool works. So in that sense, everything is fine. Then there are a couple issues that when I was reading through the specification of how you were defining this tool, how you were using, or how you were filtering and classifying the literature, some ideas came to mind, and also some omissions, and I will explain. So first of all, it's a curiosity, but it has also a deeper implication. But why have you used Scopus as the database from which you have extracted the information instead of, for example, DBLP?
Can you specify?
Well, you have taken your data, the literature has been, abstracts and titles have been taken from Scopus, right?
Not Scopus, this was from Web of Knowledge.
Web of Knowledge, well.
Yeah.
I saw one reference to Scopus, and I don't know.
I suppose it was in some other place to actually just see how the number of articles has been increasing.
Okay.
So Scopus has a good tool for plotting that. So
okay. So nevertheless, my question stands. So why have you used the Web of Knowledge, which is, of course, a very valuable resource, but why haven't you considered, given the particularities of this field, the DBLP, the Computer Science Bibliography? Because one of the problems that we have in computer science is the fact that a very large part of our research is conducted in conferences, and those conferences are not adequately covered, not by Scopus, by the Web of Knowledge or any of those major databases which are very appropriate, for example, for pure sciences, but not so much for computer science. So why have you chosen that tool instead of?
Yeah, this is one of the major limitations of our current implementation. It's a technical issue. We don't have imports for other databases there. We would have to have proper interface from whatever database we use. Web of Knowledge was used in our original research. No, actually not in the original one, but that was the next step, which is actually documented here for the first time. Trying to look for the other guys, hands up, who are doing this work jointly with me. But but really, this is the first time we're publishing, and now it's by their permission in my book, and I've contributed a lot, so it's not a problem for me, or shouldn't be for others. But definitely, it's our next step. Actually, our original one was doing web scraping. This has issues, bad issues. Our next step was that we already have a subscription paid by the University of Jyväskylä to Web of Knowledge, the basic dataset, which doesn't include conference articles. We know it's a limitation which needs to be lifted. How to lift it? It's when this thing continues, we need to negotiate with whatever provider who is collecting this metadata for conferences. And I still think we must use a big provider who is collecting many conferences, or most. I don't think anybody can collect all, but we need to negotiate data export from.
Well, the computer science bibliography at DBLP at the University of Trier is open, so anyone can access it. And it also you can very easily download an XML file of everything. So I think it would be very easy. So
I'm quite sure it's going to be our next step.
Okay, but sure. There are a couple of issues that I don't know if you have considered, but because here we are dealing not just with the analysis of the data, but also with the issues of data presentation and data format and so on. So I'm not sure if you have considered, and if not, then have a work for those students that you mentioned, that to build intermediate layers in order to translate whatever data you are extracting from a certain database into a some common intermediate format that can be fed to your algorithm, so you can really forget about the format and just
source of the data
and just concentrate on the data itself.
Yeah, definitely. Well, that's what we're doing, basically, with the structure of the program. We have an export and import component as of now for Web of Knowledge. You would need this import component for whatever format is coming in, because mm-hmm. they differ. But definitely, technically, it's just a matter of adding a component.
Yeah, it's not simple as that. I understand. It's just a matter of implementation. But then the final result, the result of that you term, I think that with a database using a larger coverage of conferences would have been much more interesting. Before I get into what I believe may be one of the most questionable points in this chapter, one question which is also a little bit of curiosity. You are essentially focusing just on the keywords that you find in the papers. Okay, so you filter out some words that are not a part of. They don't provide any meaning, and then you identify the root words that define your topics and use them for your analysis. Okay, and you extract them from the titles and the abstracts.
Yep.
So what's the real importance of using the abstracts here? Isn't just the titles of the papers equally informative, or are you really obtaining much more information by looking at the abstract?
Originally we were using only titles and author-given keywords. Then we experiment with abstracts and certainly got more information, more connections between the articles, because there are more words. Title is so short, and keywords chosen by authors were there was so little information that really, because the method itself, it's
pretty much depending on having the same word in two articles, and then forming basically a network. So it was so little that there's not so much connection mm-hmm. between articles. Definitely it improves the system to use abstracts, and I believe that using full texts would improve it a lot more. We don't have access at the moment.
Yeah, but wouldn't, for example, keywords appearing in the title be given more importance than keywords appearing in the abstract?
Ah, importance of keyword in title. Yeah, some weighting kind of.
Because there's a lot of things. If you look at the text of the paper, you typically have a background section, so you may be mentioning a lot of things there that really doesn't have to do with the paper itself. So
of course, the background section.
You need to be careful with this. So typically, the title is more about what the paper is about. The abstract, yes, to some extent, is also true that it's more focused on the contents of the paper. Mm. But I believe that the keyword appearing in the title is more significant than the keyword appearing in the abstract.
Yeah, that's a good point. Some kind of weighting could be
okay.
Be interesting to try. Yeah.
Good. Then you go to great lengths explaining. I think that you're using something like. You 2, 3, 4 pages explaining the query that you have made to the database to introduce all the relevant topics in the result of your query. Well, it's never that very interesting to see how this selection of terms affects the output that you get. Let me also mention as an anecdote that. I was facing or was realizing, and this was also pointed out by Pablo Moscato, that there was a trend a few years ago. It was not widespread, but a lot of people, when working on the TSP, the Traveling Salesman problem, they started to call the problem the Traveling Salesperson problem in order to avoid some so sexist language, which I believe is not the case, but and the fact is that what is the result? That you are completely disrupting the way in which your bibliographical queries work, because you would not get any result on the traveling salesperson problem if you are looking for a traveling salesman problem. I find very interesting that this description of the terms that you have used, how do you have been adjusting them to really catch all these relevant works. But there is something that struck me. Why have you just focused on keywords on the papers, and you have not considered the venue, the conference, or the journal in which those papers have been published? Because if, for example, you have a paper on multi-objective optimization, even if it does not mention in the title or in the abstract neural networks, but the paper is published in the Journal of Neural Networks, then most likely it's a paper about neural networks. Or the other way around. If you have a paper on neural networks in the Evolutionary Multi-Objective Optimization Conference, then most likely it's a paper on multi-objective optimization and evolutionary and artificial neural networks.
I think that just never occurred to us. So I'm thankful that you bring it up, because this is probably true. Yeah.
Okay. I mentioned this because we have been doing similar analysis of other fields, and our bibliographical queries were based on both terms, keywords, and also venues and combinations of them. So since we were looking at intersection of different fields, we were looking for keywords from both fields, or keywords from one field and venues or journals associated to the other field, and that gives you broader sample of the results. And this is what I anticipated before. That was my biggest what I believe is the point that really could have been improved here. So you have analyzed the bibliography using a clustering approach, which has its own merits, and of course you have shown that you can cluster the bibliography, analyze the cluster that you obtain, and make sense of it, and digest it, which is fine. However, I believe that you are losing information here. You are losing a lot of information here, because what is a cluster set? And what's inside the set? Nothing. There's no structure. You only have elements. However, if you look at the elements that you have obtained, they are logically related. So they're logically related in the sense that different papers have common keywords. So a more natural, more information, a richer information representation would be a network. So you could represent papers as vertices in a network, and links would represent the concurrence of terms in that network. Or you could have a bipartite network in which you have on one side papers, on the other hand you have keywords, and you have those links between papers and keywords. And then you have a lot of more information to work with, because you do not only have this aggregation thing of having papers in the same sets, you also have something like a logical change, joining this paper with that, and then with that, and then with that. And you can define a lot of different things there. Because there is another thing that you have not considered, which is the year in which papers have been published. So you can take a dynamic approach to all of this and see how this network evolves. And you can also analyze the authors of those papers and use a network in which the vertices are the authors and they are linked if they have been co-authors in one paper. And then you have a glimpse of the whole research community in that area, and you see how that network changes a long time, and you see what are the research practices in the field. So how many authors typically does a paper require? How many different co-authors does someone typically have? How often or how useful is for someone to start collaborating with some other one, or whether this is dependent or not on how many collaborators that other person had before, or whether there is some propension to work with people who are closer to you in this network. There are many, many things that can be done. Some of those things have been done by yourself, as I mentioned before, in some bibliographical analysis of another community of computer science. And this actually, if we go to page 97, to say, it's at the beginning of section 4.2.3. The real magnum opus would then be to automatically cluster the set of articles to categories that would provide yet more insight into what kind of subtopics are involved in the field, how active or recent these subtopics would be, and which would be the most relevant for the published results of them. This is exactly the kind of thing that a network representation would provide. This is the kind. Actually, this section is called structural view. So in order to have a structural view, you need a structure. So if you only have a clustering, well, you have some a structure. If this clustering is hierarchical, you have some this hierarchical structure. But this, I think, it's not the structure you're looking at. You're just looking at the separate clusters. So that's why I think that you should or you could have been done much better here. I don't know if you were aware of this network approach for analyzing bibliographical data or?
Yeah, it's the story is written in the beginning of section four. we were definite beginners when we started, and the whole story is in the book. We've been learning what informatics is, what is mapping of science. We've been learning what we do, and we have found out how low level we're doing at the moment. These network approaches, of course, they are, have been done since 70s, at least by the big players. And there's citations to the actual big players, algorithms. So definitely, it's we're beginners. We're beginners in this.
So you already have the data because you have you have done the one of the things is often one of the difficult steps is to obtain the data. So once that you have the data, it's relatively easy to do that, even using some freely available software that is around that allows you to just upload your network. You just have to define your network in some standard network description language, and then you upload it to the software, and you immediately obtain a lot of different measures of structural properties of your network and a lot of important things that you could analyze. And so one of those things, precisely, is, well, you have considered this recursive clustering approach. And, well, everything at the end boils down to not having used the network approach, because you say in page 88, you say, this is at the end of section 411, you say, we iteratively reclustered the largest remaining cluster until no further cluster of reasonable size appeared. So what is reasonable? So this is a completely fuzzy term. It's what's reasonable for you?
I believe this was talking about the original version, which is in the cited paper. Reasonable, yes, it was something like 10% of the.
And why is that reasonable?
I think we explained it in some way in the article or not.
I think not.
But we, of course we saw that we saw how this is a problem. Well, of course we knew that this is not definite in any way. So in this new version, we cluster all the way to the end that we can. So make as small clusters as possible. Of course, now it's up to the user to come up with his or her own reasonable size.
So, as I said before, this at the end, the problem with this is the fact that you have not considered the network approach, because if you go to networks, one of the standard things that can be done on networks is so-called community finding. So what is a cluster? It's just a community of papers. That what is a community? It's a subset of those vertices in the network that are tightly connected among themselves more than they are with the rest of the network. So obviously you don't need to have a complete click for having a community. You only need to show that those nodes in that part of the network are more frequently connected among them than they are with the rest of the network. And there are several standard metrics in the network literature on this. A very simple one is just to say, I count how many edges I have in my whole network. So this is the average density of the network. So this is the average probability that two networks are connected. And if the nodes in this subset have among themselves a higher density than they have the average network, then they form a community. And it turns out that this is also a recursive procedure that you can follow, because what you do is to start removing links from the network until those communities start to appear. And when you have different components in your network, you recursively apply the same mechanism, and you use this criterion to stop. So if at some point you break or break in the network, you obtain two subnetworks whose densities or whose relative relationships are the same as the original network, it makes no sense to divide them because they are together. So using this arbitrary parameter, like what the reasonable size is, I think that can artificially introduce some artifacts in the results, like clusters that are not really homogeneous because you have selected a too large value of the parameter, or subclusters that are too small and really belong to a larger set just because you have chosen a very small set.
Yes, yes, you're correct. We did observe this problem in the original version, and then we updated the method to actually mm-hmm. not have this parameter beforehand. So.
Okay, but
I'm sure you're totally correct about the network algorithms. Mm-hmm. Would definitely be.
I'd say that given the state of the work, given that you have the data, it's just a natural thing to do, and it would be a lost opportunity not to do so because. There's a lot of information there that you are not catching because just you're focusing on an unstructured view of the data. Well, you throughout this chapter you use and I admit I was not completely familiar with that tool, that those diffusion maps.
Yeah.
They're very, very nice mathematical tools. I did that research in order to learn more about those tools, and they are nice. They are interesting. So if we look at the result of these diffusion maps, we get that, what you're doing is to embed your multidimensional data into a lower dimensionality space. And as a result, you get something which is not completely separable. So you have overlaps, I think, between the data points in which you obtain a cloud of points which are not clearly separated, right? Just by looking at the figures that you have in
the figures of these embedded points.
So yep. my question is: you try to do clustering, or let's say to be more precise, a crisp clustering of the data. So why haven't you considered using a fuzzy clustering approach, which is seems natural given the fact that this overlap.
One reason for this is that when I had written this chapter, and it so more or less needed to be final at that point, I realized that why did we use crisp clustering? Why not fuzzy? So definitely, it is. I do mention it here. It's the current version is limited by this.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's just like networks. Is there's a lot of tools available for fuzzy clustering that you can readily deploy on your data.
To answer a question that would be, why should anybody use crisp clustering in this kind of task? I would now say that no reason for that.
Mm-hmm.
For no reason.
So another question, which is related to the use of these diffusion maps. They seem to work and they seem to do the job they were used to. But why using them instead of other dimensionality reduction techniques like principal component analysis or using, for example, a self-organized map?
This for the original paper, where this method comes from. This was our selling point of the paper, that we use diffusion maps that has not been used in this kind of literature scientometrics thing yet. Mm-hmm. That was the case. And it was very handy to actually have a couple of research groups here working with diffusion maps at that time. Including an industrial project where I was in. So it was sort of quite natural to try out how would this work. And it was selling point of the paper that we're making use of diffusion maps in a new field. Mm-hmm. As of then.
Okay, yes, I see that there's some value, of course, in showing a new tool applied to a new domain. So this is a novel application, which is fine. But have you compared the results with what you would have obtained using other approach to see if it is the same or not? Because if it is the same, then the question is there any advantage in using this? Because maybe this turns out to be more efficient or turns out to be had some advantage or not. And if the results are not the same, then the question is, in which sense they are different? What is telling me this result? What are they telling me that those other methods are not telling me, vice versa? So have you compared diffusion maps with other techniques and see how they...
Scientifically, you got to the weak point, which I know about the work. We haven't done those comparisons. So it's a method I can tell you that it works. It works surprisingly well. How it compares to using just PCA linear mm-hmm. method, we haven't done the test. Scientifically, you really...
Okay, no, so it's something.
The weak spot in there.
Yeah, but it's something that, for example, if I'm as a journal reviewer got a paper on something which is novel, my first thought is always to say, okay, this is novel, but it is better in some sense than what we had before. So this is something that you have to be careful. I'm not saying that this is. In no way this is a bad approach. I say that I like it very much, but you need to sell that, and you need to sell the advantages of this method with respect to previous methods. Okay? Now you do something interesting and curious in section 4-6. In section 4-6, is entitled A Minor Overview with Reordered Titles and Abstracts. And what you do is, you have your tree, your hierarchical clustering, and what you do essentially is to reorder the leaves of the tree to have some continuity. I don't know, because it's not mentioned here, but I don't know if you have realized that this is a classical combinatorial problem. This is a Trevelyan search one problem that you're solving here.
Oh.
So you do not need to do that manually. You can really automate that. So it's a standard combinatorial problem. So you have...
Of course it's...
This is a problem that... also happens in the context, and this is something that I will talk now a little bit about. The general approach that we have followed is analogous to some things that are usually done in bioinformatics when you are considering data from, for example, from Merck array. So you have a number of samples belonging to different individuals, and you have the readings for all the gene activity of those individuals. So you have these metrics. And you may want to reorder the rows. If each row represents a gene, then you may want to reorder the rows of the matrix in such a way that genes with a similar expression, similar activity, are close together, so you visually can see which genes are co-expressed and which are not. This can be solved just by computing a distance matrix between elements and then running a TSP solver on them. That can be done, for example, using a memetic algorithm. So you have your memetic algorithm, you can run it. So you were not aware of this connection.
Actually, I wasn't. Yeah.
Okay.
Now that you mention it, I see it very clearly.
Okay. So it's something that you can really use, because you do not need any manual processing of the data for doing this. And this, and we observe this in several bioinformatic problems. This gives you additional information. So if you have a phylogeny of different organisms, which is a hierarchical tree at the end, it's not the same, or you're not obtaining the same information from that tree if the leaves in the tree are just randomly arranged, of course, respecting the hierarchy. So within each branch that represents a cluster at some level, you can flip the branches and swap left by right and obtain a different reordering of the nodes. And some ordering turns out to be more informative than others. And that's exactly what you have been aiming to here, to find a meaningful order of the leaves, which is exactly this problem. So just tell you this, just to save you work and also to have you not reinvented the wheel again, because it's been done. Okay. This also takes me. I have mentioned this connection to bioinformatics, and another thing that is commonly done in bioinformatics is when you do clustering, is to do a bi-clustering. So you have your metrics. And you do not only want to cluster the rows, you also want to cluster the columns. Okay, so it seems to me that you have not considered this approach. So in this case, your matrix, each row is a paper, each column would be a keyword. Okay, so you are grouping together rows, papers with similar keywords, but you are not grouping together keywords, which would be keywords that are related because they commonly appear together in papers. So they are, they represent some kind of related issues in research. So again, you had not considered this, right?
No, we have.
Okay. But this is something that there are also many standard algorithms for bi-clustering that you can use for this purpose. So I really wanted to encourage you to try this and see what you obtain. Okay, I think it could be interesting also because you mentioned before that that was the previous quote that about this structural view of getting more insight into what kind of subtopics are involved in the field and how actives are, with how relevant they are. So seeing how they occur together really gives you some information. You have a cluster that not only represents a thematic field, papers related to the same field, but also keywords that appear together. So that's an important finding, I think. Now, there's another issue that we're advancing now to chapter 5, I think. In this chapter, you go to discuss the elements that should be present in a memetic approach to optimize or to train a multi-layer perceptron. One of the issues that you recognize is it's mentioned on page 117. It's in section 5.1, this is the third bullet item. You say a full archive of non-dominated solutions should be kept throughout the iteration. Now, I'm not sure that if or the implication of this has been fully explored, in the sense that you are tackling a continuous optimization problem, meaning that you can have solutions whose genotype differs only on the 10th decimal place, and correspondingly the fitness differs only on the 9th decimal place, and they may be non-dominated to each other. So those two solutions will be in the Pareto front. So the problem is that the Pareto front can grow enormously, can be exponentially large because of this, because this continuous nature of the solutions and the fitness that you're trying to optimize.
Yep. Yes, I think I was thinking about an archive that gets a limited number of updates from, let's say, the population. Then you add new non-dominated ones to the archive. Not the intermediate points while doing a local search, which could differ only slightly.
But even if they're not the result, I mean, even the final results, it could be the case that every time that you update your population, your new population is completely composed of non-dominated solutions. Just because you are changing a little bit the weights, and they are different from the previous one, they are non-dominated. So you are essentially approximated a continuous surface. And that continuous surface can have an enormous number of points, of course. So if you are somehow limiting the input to that archive of solutions, you need to define a criterion for accepting or not a solution there, not just the fact that they are non-dominated. So have you considered this, or what criterion you could use?
Yeah, it's not we're not at that point in the roadmap of deciding these issues. For limited tests, it's a totally manageable number, because you'd have to run for so many iterations to actually run into problems with this kind of complete archiving. Definitely, there would have to be criterion, maybe some tolerance.
That's the usual solution, to use some kind of clustering. To measure some kind of crowding distance, so you will not accept points into this collection of non-dominated solutions if they are too similar, too close to solutions that you already have. So, because they are really not contributing too much to the information that you have there. Okay, so that's really the solution. And of course you have to be careful, and I guess this may depend on the problem that you're trying to solve, on whether the Pareto front is smooth or not, because then maybe you have some, I don't know if not discontinuities, but you can have points of a lot of variation, so the abrupt change of the shape of the Pareto front that would indicate some kind of transition from a set of solutions that were essentially approaching optimality in some way to solutions that are approaching optimality in some other way. So like crossing some complexity boundary, and all of a sudden there is a big degradation in accuracy or whatever, and there is, you can have something which is not very smooth. So in that case, you have to be careful, because maybe it's important to have more information on those transitional points than on more.
Yeah, you would be
more monotonic
wasting
parts.
Space. You would be wasting space with interesting solutions. Yeah. True.
So you mentioned the different issues. One issue that. That I don't know if it was stated here. is this, we are talking about memetic algorithms that we have been discussing before. Local search is very important. And it's not only important by itself, by the fact that it contributes to improved solutions. It's also important to the extent that it can provide a synergy with the rest of the algorithm. So so there is some kind of interplay between local and population-based search that you have to fine-tune. So depending, this is commonly observed in many combinatorial optimization problems. So, but I think it's also the case here and in any other optimization problem that if you have a very intensive local search mechanism, then you may want to have a populational based gene that promotes more diversity. In order to of course compensate, because if your population-based gene does not promote diversity, it turns out that you cross two solutions, you do local search, and you obtain again the one of the solutions that you had at the beginning. So the you have to so to say to separate the parents in order to exploit the strong searching capability of the local search if your local search mechanisms have that property. Or the other way around. So there is this interplay. And I think it's not captured, or at least not described here, that you have to take this into account. So I think this is an omission that...
May have been too clear a point to mention. It's in the papers. You can see it always considered. What is the interplay? How should it be done? Mm. So,
of course, if you're not using crossover, that you may use or not. If you're not using crossover, it turns out that you have a very interesting memetic approach because it's more like a collection of local search. That compete to each other, essentially. So in that case, you don't have crossover. It's one thing less to care about an interplay between local search and crossover, of course. But then you could have different ways of doing local search. So that's another thing that you could take into account. So different local search mechanisms that could be useful in different stages of the search and that could also cooperate in some sense. So because where it is a local optimum from one local search need not be an optimum local optimum for another local search. So one local search can help another one to escape from this kind of optimum. So those are things that are, as I said, very, very, very often observed in combinatorial optimization, but I think it's pretty much the same issue here in continuous.
I believe it would be here as well. Mm-hmm.
Now, getting to the experimental data, and we are now in chapter 6. But also this was mentioned because at the beginning of the thesis, you illustrate some of the ideas using figures which are also here in this last session, in last chapter. I'm just curious because I'm not familiar with the term, so I would like you to elaborate a little bit about what really means the idea of sub-concepts.
can you tell me where you find this?
So, for example,
sub-concepts.
Yeah, sub-concepts. Yeah. What does it mean a sub-concept in?
Yep, and
set up data.
I
think it's mentioned at the beginning in the introduction.
Yeah.
When you show the data or the graphs.
Yep, in the section 2, there's figure about, and it's in the figure captions.
In the figure captions, you say here we have separable class, class with subconcept or with noisy data. But you have different cases.
Yes, this word subconcept. comes from this cited article 2009 and Garcia. It means if you look at the do you have any of the figures 10 or
figure 10
figure
okay.
10
yeah
shows sub concept when you have the circles they are not only in the big area where you have the circles that's let's say one concept where circles happen. Now you also have separate pieces with circles in two other places. These are the sub-concepts of a circle in this.
So it is like different clusters of data?
Yep, if I remember correctly from this.
But is this something that can be somehow formalized mathematically? Or is it just some kind of high-level interpretation of the data?
I'm sure you can build measures for this, but I didn't consider those. Of course,
I do not clearly understand the difference, if there is any, between subconcepts and class overlap. It's the same. I mean overlap.
No, if I'm not mistaken, which I may be, I think it is like it is. It's not overlap. That is because you can have circles in here. You could have these triangles overlap the circles, but still they would be in one, let's say, cluster. Mm. So if I'm not remembering or understood incorrectly, then it means the separate. Perhaps clusters are
okay,
a word I could use here.
So this issue with the sub-concepts and also with the overlap takes me to another consideration, which is the fact that if this is not really an artifact of the representational space that you are using, so that if you somehow transform your representation space using some transformation of the, for example, in this figure 10, you have x1, x2. If you make some transformation of x1, x2 into some two different variants using some function, then all of a sudden those overlapping classes are separable. So it could be that happened.
Quite sure you'd always find a function that actually does that.
Okay, so this takes me to another issue. Maybe it's novel in this area. Maybe it's not. I think it's not mentioned here because I made a search throughout the electronic version of the document of genetic programming. I found a couple of references to genetic programming, but not in the sense that I was looking for, which is, so you know that genetic programming is a way of evolving a program, or in particular a function. And actually it's used sometimes in this kind of machine learning context to evolve, for example, the kernel function of a support vector machine. So use instead of having a predefined linear or whatever, use an arbitrary kernel defined by genetic programming. So you might very well have this genetic programming approach to evolve or look for a suitable transformation of, I wouldn't say transformation, because you do not need to lose the information that you already have. You can just add new information. So it's like creating a new variable, creating a new feature, which is
feature generation using genetic programming. Yeah. That's being done definitely.
That way things that look to be non-separable, that look to be overlapping, or that look like subconcepts maybe, are separated in this way. It's just like if you project, for example, all the integer numbers on a line and you want to separate even numbers from odd numbers, you say, okay, I can because they are completely mixed. But then if I add a new dimension, which is the parity, yeah, all of a sudden they are in different dimensions, so you can very easily separate them. Okay, so maybe there is a lot of things that could be done. I think they have been done, in, as I said before, and future evolution. I think that mostly, I think I have seen something in the context of decision trees and this kind of techniques. I'm not so sure about their use in the context of neural networks. So maybe something worth exploring here. Now, what you do have in chapter 6 is what you call the traced complexity measure. Are those panes? You have the figures with two panes, and on the left hand side you have your data cloud and some hyperplane or something like that. On the right you have this trajectory of complexity. First of all, I must say that it was a bit difficult to understand these figures, because you are not using any informative axis level. So you use F1, F2. So what is F1 and what is F2? So I had to go to the text, and even in the text it's not defined. The closest that I found was that you are representing, I don't know where it is, you are representing the mean square error and the mean of square weights of the MLP. Still, I do not know which one is one. So if F1 is a mean square error or the other way around. So this is one problem with these figures. Then you use a small point and an open cycle. I understand this is to indicate the origin and the destination of the trajectory. I understand that the open cycle is the end point, or is the...
Yeah, that's the end point, yeah.
Is the end point. Okay, so by inspection of these traces, for example, that one in figure 23 or that one in figure 24, it's more clearly in 24, I'd say. What we are looking at 24, isn't it an indication of overfitting at the end of the trajectory?
Yeah, well, in this case, because in here it is possible to visualize the data, mm-hmm. What would you say? If it's overfitting, it's fitting perfectly because now the data is separable. Because if you look at the figure 24, the data set is on the left pane and there's clear space between. So in here,
I mean overfitting because you get a very, if I understand correctly, F1 is the mean square error, right? On the horizontal axis, what you have is the square error, and on the vertical axis, what you have is this mean of square weights.
Yep.
So by the end of the trajectory, you get a very small decrease in the mean square error, but a very high increase in the value of the weights.
Yes, and this is what is the purpose of illustration, that if you run an iterative MLP training with local search, you can run it as long as you want, and it will always fit more and more, create bigger and bigger weights. That's what happens, that leads to overfitting if your data is...
That's my
point. Yes, definitely, that is it's the illustration of how it always goes. And it's the source of your overfitting problem if your data is like that. In this case, hard to say if it's fitting perfectly or over, because it's separable mm-hmm. in any case.
Good. Another comment. And you have mentioned that a couple of times, that it's also mentioned in the manuscript that you have a repository with your code, which is open source?
Yeah, it's linked and it's supposed to be open. It's, I suppose, I don't remember if it has yet a license.txt, but it's definitely supposed to be, and it's open, it's published here and it's over there. And it's actually a version controlled repository, but it's not, as of now, there's a snapshot.
Okay,
so that we just get this publication thing done with. So definitely when I have time, I'll.
If I understood it correctly, it's also because of legal requirements of in Finland, or that your research has to be open source, or
It's not a requirement. I think it's mentioned somewhere in the very first introduction thing. There's this open science initiative.
Okay, so it's more like a recommendation than a
and a future like. Recommendation, definitely. And
so, what's your opinion on this? Or
I think it's the only way to go. We should have everything open source, at least algorithms.
But there are also different ways in which you can approach open source initiatives. So, depending on when you make your code open to the community. So, what's actually your vision that you should make things open as you are developing them, or only after you have finished your paper and submitted it, or only after your paper has been accepted, or what's exactly your opinion?
These are interesting questions, definitely, and I think there are many answers, and I think it depends. I think it depends. If I had a breakthrough algorithm, and it was. It's not yet published, it's not pushed to the open repository. I think I would like to publish a paper, and when I'm sure that it's printed or published over there, then same day I could push the changes, which publish this new breakthrough algorithm. So far I don't have breakthrough algorithms, so I've been dealing with this problem yet, but if this happened, then I think in that case I would definitely push it to the open repository after the publication is clear.
Would this also apply to the data generated? I mean, in this case maybe it's a bit different, I mean, in computer science with respect to other fields, because you are not really the data is typically the output of your algorithms rather than some other scenario data. But for example, in biology, it's very common that you get your data from biological experiments, and then you want to analyze them using your algorithm. So it is as important the data as the
algorithms. Definitely. I think it's repeatability. It's the fundamentals of doing science. It must be repeatable. So if there is a publication, I would hope that there is also executable source code version which can be made into executable in our sense, and all the data, or a generator for the data. In biology, it's their way of putting out the repeatability requirements. Mm-hmm. But there, in medical sciences, it's very, very careful how they list all the numbers of the equipment that was used, very detailed, how to actually repeat the experiment.
Also because it's very often it's very expensive to get the data, so you're making something available for free, something that may have cost. But then again, it's the issue of whether this is something that has been generated using funds, for example, from a public institution, so maybe there is this requirement that whatever has been generated using public funds should be freely available to the public. So it makes sense.
Yeah, and I think these initiatives are, if they become obligatory guidelines to follow, I'm sure it can be only publicly funded organizations, which is rather unfortunate for some cases. I've been recently working with very interesting data from mobile network operators, actual operational data, which we have the access to granted, but But of course, we cannot publish that. It's totally proprietary data, and of course, it has issues with privacy issues of people using them.
Yes,
so not all data can be free, unfortunately.
Yeah, even if you take care of those personal information, if you carefully anonymize everything that you have in your data set, still, I can see why a company may be reluctant to give away those data, because it gives valuable information about the way in which they are conducting their business, which can be used by the competitors to be done. So I really think there's no easy solution here. Maybe that the solution is that we have two separate worlds. One is the world of scientific research, another one is the world of applications or industrial applications. And
I think in a perfect world, we could anonymize and publish even the proprietary data, but then I think it's going to be a long journey towards companies wanting to do this.
Well, one of the things that I know that is sometimes, couldn't tell how often, but I know it is done in the biological sciences, is that biological data, is published, but with the noise added on them. So it's not exactly the original data. So it's somehow it's a large-scale representation of the data, but the fine detail is not there. So but some kind of compromise between keeping everything for free or not. So it's better than nothing. There's one interesting issue here in this open software thing. I'm keeping close research relationship with people who are deeply involved in open software initiatives. I mean, from a deeply rooted ideological point of view. So they strongly advocate for that. And I have observed that one of the things that they most profoundly despise is MATLAB. Because it's a proprietary software and so on. So it's the perfect epitome of what is not open software. So I see that you, however, have published MATLAB code, or so you say, that you're including MATLAB code in your...
All the figures come from Octave.
Octave, okay.
Which uses the MATLAB language of scientific computing, but it's open source.
Octave is, an open source system. Clone of MATLAB.
I've made very carefully codes that run both on Octave and MATLAB. Mm-hmm. Of course, it puts restrictions with this MATLAB you could do.
Okay, MATLAB, of course, I personally think that even if it is, the MATLAB system is proprietary, of course you have these clones like Octave. And so also most institutions have access to MATLAB, so it's really not implying a strong constraint on what open source means, other than the fact that you may not like that MathWorks is earning money from the universities. Then, of course, there are alternatives to MATLAB, like using R or using any other package. But you plan to stick to MATLAB?
As long as it runs on Octave, which I use for developing.
Because you're not using any particular toolbooks or something like that. You're just using Git for...
Not in this work. We do use statistics toolbox in the literature review codes. It's basically a couple of functions. We could lift them from there. And
good.
Yeah, I try to stick with open source platforms. Yeah.
Good. So and actually, your view is that even in journals, it should be a requirement to have
requirement. In a perfect world, there could be, but I think to that it's still also a long way But I think it would improve definitely the state of computational sciences. It would be so easy to publish along with the article, the codes.
Okay, so because what is in your opinion? Why do you think people is not wanting to give away their code? What do you think are the most common reasons?
Could be many reasons. Sometimes I'm waiting for the time to actually make the codes better and more polished before. Didn't happen this time at all. But that could be one reason that people are shy about the codes. But of course, regarding scientific results that you state in your article, then shyness should not play a role, because then it's basically you don't know if it's honest shyness or if it's just results with actual nothing inside. It's just only the results. How have you come up with this? So you don't know. So basically, philosophically, everybody should require executable code with computational results. Unfortunately, it doesn't happen. I don't know why.
No. Okay. Good. So that was actually my last question. So I think I've reached a point where I can make a final concluding statement on your work. And in my opinion, the word in this thesis, I mentioned that at the beginning, and I reaffirm my statement that the work is highly valuable. It has a value from a scientific point of view, and also this change with the candidate has provided evidence to me that he's well aware of course, of the work that he has done, also of the work that is being done in the community, and that he's has scientific maturity to defend his position on the issue. So therefore, I will be happy to recommence the acceptance of this doctoral dissertation.
Thank you.
After this, I solicit those people who have some critical comments regarding my thesis to ask for an address from the Kustos.
Koska kysymyksiä ei esitetty, julistan väitöstilaisuuden päättyneeksi.
Okay. Before we go, I would like to thank the audience for your interest coming here. There is now a coffee service provided by the Faculty of Information Technology, located in the entrance hall of this building. You're all welcome. And sama suomeksi. Miten se meni? Kiitokset yleisölle mielenkiinnosta. Heti tämän jälkeen informaatioteknologian tiedekunta tarjoaa kaikille kahvit tämän rakennuksen aulassa. Missä on kello? Mä missä? Tässä näin ennen kuin